is dialogue. Dialogue, a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.
This is Dialogue Assassination with political research specialist Mae Brussel. For KLRB, I'm Phil Kogan.
I'm Mae Brussel.
Who else?
Who else but Mae Brussel?
Good afternoon, Mae, and welcome again to Dialogue Assassination. Of course, I shouldn't welcome you because you are Dialogue Assassination, essentially. What is Dialogue Assassination for those who have just started in the middle of this this series of ongoing programs?
Dialogue Assassination is a discussion of news that is taking place each week since the program last Saturday. It's a continuous series every Saturday afternoon, and we take the news of the week and discuss those things that pertain to the particular political assassinations in the United States, the killing of President John Kennedy, of the senator and candidate Robert Kennedy, and the killing of Martin Luther King, how it affected the ascension of Spiro Agnew into the seat of vice presidency, and other political assassinations, the Panthers, or the Sharon Tate massacre in Los Angeles, which was a political massacre. It pertains to all the political assassinations. A lot of people are confused when I bring Manson in as a political patsy, such as Sirhan and Ray and Oswald. But I got a letter from Joe Justine. He has a newsletter from Germany that goes out all over the world every 2 weeks, and he's written 7 books on the political assassinations. And just yesterday, Justine's letter was the CIA gets into witchcraft and Satanism, and they're beginning to say that Oswald, they have a book coming out saying Oswald was under the influence of Satan. And Justine caught on finally that as another cover story, the CIA is going to use the occult as the excuse for the motive of, they've used it as the motive for the massacre in Los Angeles and Scientology influencing Sirhan or Manson. And these weren't the real reasons for killing the people we've mentioned. But now they're going back and trying to say Oswald was into the occult. And I sent a letter off to Justin and said, I've told you all along that the CIA will use this as their next cover story. They've used up the communist bit and the other cover stories, so they're going to the occult. I brought in a book. I just got it this week. It's a new book, and I like to recommend books for you to buy, preferably to buy, order from the bookstore, or go to the library and ask them to get this book. The library is wonderful about getting books for all of the various readers who are checking. The commission hearings at the Carmel Library now, and one person I know has the first 10 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings. There's 26 volumes, and he's checked them out. They will procure these books if you want them. Now, there's a new book out by E.H. Cookridge. It just came out called Galen, the Spy of the Century. And on the cover, it has a picture of the German eagle, the symbol, that double eagle of Nazi Germany. And one side is black with a red beak, and the other half is like the American flag, red, white, and blue. The wings are red and white, and the head is blue. And under the title of Galen, I'm going to read you the book cover. It says, Reinhard Galen first served as Hitler's chief intelligence officer against the Soviet Union. His second boss in the same capacity was the CIA. And you turn the back over, and it has a list of questions that are covered in the book. Who was Richard General Reinhard Galen? And I'm not going to read the list now. I'm going to do a whole show on him in a few weeks when I complete reading the book. But it says his Galen organization was financed by the CIA to the extent of $200 million through his close friend Alan Dulles. He's living in a home that Alan Dulles bought him in Germany. This man is wanted as a top Nazi criminal if ever he sets his foot outside of a villa. It's interesting, Reinhard Galen was the head of Nazi intelligence for Hitler of the Eastern Division. Then he worked with Alan Dulles and became He formed our CIA, the backbone of our CIA, with Alan Dulles, and we took his agents and incorporated them into our CIA. He's made one trip to the outside of his villa in Nazi Germany, from Germany to the Dulles estate that was bought for him outside of his headquarters. It was to Monterey, California, to the spy school. in Monterey, California. That's the only place that Reinhard Gehlen has been outside of Germany since he's been Hitler's intelligence chief in Monterey at the spy school. It says for a quarter of a century he was involved in almost every major espionage intrigue. Now, why do I talk about this book? For people who have listened to the show for the past 8 months, I've mentioned Reinhard Gehlen many times and the Gehlen operation. There's a chapter of him in the book, The Espionage Establishment. And when you open the book on Reinhard Gehlen, the first chapter is on Alan Dulles. And the author says, you may wonder why I begin my book on the spy of the century talking about Alan Dulles. And he said, because Alan Dulles created Reinhard Gehlen. They formed the CIA together. And it's a fascinating book of intrigue, plotting, and devising. So it was intelligence, clandestine government that he devised for our government like they did in Nazi Germany. Now, I got onto the Gehlen operation when I was cross-filing the people from the commission hearings that I referred to, the 26 volumes, the witnesses that were friends of Lee and Marina Oswalds in the Soviet Union, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I realized that they had come through the Gehlen operation, that they were all Nazis placed in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, or most of them were associated and filtered with the Gehlen operation. And when I broke down all the Nazis who were involved in the political assassinations that take place in this country, they came through the Gehlen operation. So you can see why this book coming out now. There's many chapters on them, and there's two books on the stand, a paperback and this hardbound. But it's a very important book, E.H. Cookridge, Gehlen, Spy of the Century. Now, you read a book about Gehlen, and you read about the things that he was into, 70% of all the espionage involvements that have taken place in the last quarter of a century, and he supplied 70% of intelligence for NATO. Why is that important? Because when you break down the particular operation of a political conspiracy, you get to the nitty-gritty of the actual evidence of the murder. The way these intelligence agents work is they plant evidence against the innocent. They plant witnesses to say a particular person is guilty. They subvert the system of justice in a way that you don't know truth from fiction. And the actual operation of the intelligent agent is something different than the overall planning. So today I wanted to go into one facet, one little detail of how an intelligence operation, like the Gehlen operation that incorporates with our CIA works. And I bring it up because in the news today, all the discussions on the ITT memo, you know, what took place in Mrs. Beard. And I brought an article from the New York Times and one from the Washington Bureau, Mercury Washington Bureau, from the San Jose Mercury, on one subject, which is the destruction of evidence in the Washington office, that the International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation took sacks of papers from the files of the Washington office the day after Jack Anderson's column came out and destroyed them. And they said the primary reason for feeding the papers into a shredder was to destroy documents that would cause unwarranted embarrassment. Now, I'm going to discuss the destruction of the evidence in this ITT case, and then I'm going into the destruction of the evidence of the John Kennedy murder, because this is the way an intelligence operation, one way that they work is to siphon out of town or destroy or break any evidence of a system that is going to go before the courts. They incorporate their power. ITT has offices in Germany, Austria, all over the world. And we're not going to go into the structure of that particular corporation, but the lawyers went into that office and destroyed the documents. Mr. Abel, one of the security men, disclosed that some of the shredded documents did pertain to the San Diego Convention and others concerned the antitrust settlement. And Senator John V. Tunney of California said, "This looks bad on the face." He added that the international telephone employees could hardly be expected to acknowledge now that the documents already destroyed linked the corporation to the convention pledge or the antitrust settlement. Now, the interim reports were all burned, and the New York lawyers came out to give advice to the national telephone employees about the legal liabilities that would be incurred by destroying these papers. And in the morning, the next morning after Jack Anderson's article came out, The 25-member staff was told that their files were an open sieve, that they had to be destroyed. Now, Tunney made a statement in the paper this week, since I was on the air last week. He's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I suggest that people who are listening that want to know what to do, they always say, is there anything we can write to government? Which congressman should we write to? How can we get the truth on the political assassinations? I suggest you write to Senator John Tunney, and you could send me a copy of your letter and his answer to the station here if you want to. He's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he said that it was outrageous that they had an office document shredding party after the memo was reprinted. And Tunney said this, in quotes, "Under common law, when a person destroys evidence, they say that it is a presumption of guilt," end quote, "that they come in." Now, I think we should write to our congressmen and ask them what happened after the President of the United States was killed, because I would like to, in this program, discuss 11 pieces of evidence that were totally destroyed or locked up that would prove or help prove who killed John Kennedy. And we're talking about, I keep saying over again, the President of the United States was killed. The most important evidence to me was the destruction of the car interior.
Okay, now we're going from IT&T.
From IT&T, the destruction of the evidence there, that it is easy when a corporation is about to be prosecuted for an antitrust suit and they make a settlement out of court, and when they're being investigated on the nature of this settlement, they come right in and pulverize everything in the office, every memo and letter. So I'm moving from today's destruction of evidence to the way the government worked in 1963, because nothing has changed except that is a personal antitrust suit between the business and the government, and this is deciding who the President of the United States will be. And this is the way the evidence was handled when John Kennedy was murdered.
Okay, so this is destroyed evidence from the research surrounding the John Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, you see, it's important to go over this because some of this has never been chronicled or discussed openly on the air or in the news media, and people do not realize what happened when John Kennedy was killed, or how do you do your research to say there was a conspiracy. So many people listening were very young when that event took place or never did any thinking about the solving of that crime. They thought because there was a commission appointed to investigate the murder that the murder was solved. But I want to show you what the commission had to work on. And the first thing they had to work on was the car interior that the president was riding in, because 3 bullet fragments were removed from the interior of that car. And we did several shows, one last week on the direction of the bullet, the impossibility that it came from a certain direction. And we did another show on the evidence of more bullets than the 3 that they said took place. I have a copy of a letter I brought in, a memo of a letter written to J. Edgar Hoover from Mr. Rankin, the chief counsel for the Warren Commission, describing bullet fragments taken from John Kennedy's car. One was from the front seat cushion, one was from the front seat, another one from the front seat. Now, in the hearings before the commission, there were 3 bullet fragments removed from the interior of the car. But the car was never tested to see where the bullets were located. They had pieces of bullets from the car, but they didn't say where they were located. To be in a front seat cushion, a report from the chief attorney, doesn't say whether it was on the right side or left side, whether it was consistent with the direction of where Oswald would be standing. So if we had the car interior, we may be able to know what part of the cushion. To just say front seat cushion or beside the, another one is a bullet beside the front seat.
What happened to the car? Well, weren't there pictures taken or something?
There were no photographs taken of the car. The car was airlifted to Washington, to the basement of the White House. And the next day, within 48 hours, the car was taken to Dearborn, Michigan. And the interior of the car was completely ripped out. No person.
By who?
Well, if we knew who did that, we would be halfway to solving the crime. If we know who gave the orders to destroy the car, you see, we'd be halfway to solving the crime. This is the way I figure it. Who gave the order to lift a huge car? We're going to go to pieces of paper that were burned. And you can make errors, you know, your cigarette can light up by mistake. But the interior of the presidential car, nobody knows what part of the seat the bullets were taken from. If it was on the driver's side and not on the side where John Kennedy or John Connally was sitting then. There obviously had to be a flurry of bullets, like the Secret Service agent had said.
Does anybody know why it was taken to Dearborn, Michigan?
No, nobody asks. I am asking, researchers are asking. Maybe there's 150 persons like myself who've worked continuously for 9 years, and maybe there's a few thousand others that have joined us since. But these are the things we want people to begin to ask. Why was it taken? Why wasn't it photographed? If the FBI solved so many other crimes and is on the radio, on the television every night showing how they solved these wonderful crimes, why wouldn't they photograph the interior of the car to show? You see, if you examined it, as a criminologist should, you could tell what direction the bullets came from, how far the gunman stood, and how many bullets there are, you know. But the car was completely destroyed. Now, we've gone into the fact that the x-rays of John Kennedy at the time that they were taken when he had the autopsy were never developed. Those are not destroyed, but they're locked up for 75 years, and the researchers can't have access to those x-rays.
Has anyone seen those? They've never been developed?
They were developed this year, and Dr. Latimer, the urologist from New York, was selected to go in and see them. But the New York Times called several researchers a week before he went in the archives and said, Latimer's going to go in the archives and say the Warren Commission was right. This is from a reporter from the New York Times who wrote this story for the New York Times. The story was written before he went into the archives. And he's the only man. And Burke Marshall of IBM is the only person that gives permission to see those x-rays, and they're locked up. Now, the jacket of President Kennedy is locked up in the National Archives, and that's something else that is available. It isn't destroyed yet, but the researchers want to see how many holes and the location of the holes. Now, the street sign and the lamppost were removed from in front of the book depository, and Mr. Kellerman, the Secret Service agent, said he heard a flurry of bullets. It would be nice to know what happened to the street sign and lamppost of this particular crime.
Why?
Well, I don't know why it was removed.
Apparently, no, but why would it be nice
bullet.
To know?
Because if there was a flurry of bullets, and if there's more bullets in the car, it could be that, there one bullet hit a curb, and it went over beyond the in front of the depository, down toward the street, hit the curb, ricocheted, and hit a gentleman on the face. His face was bleeding, and he needed medical attention. And the Warren Commission said he probably was hit by this bullet. There wasn't anything else flying around that area. It would be nice to know why they removed the lamppost, because there could be nicks from other bullets if it was a crossfire. You see, you could find out who gave the order to remove the sign and the lamppost and examine them like you do the street curb. Now, the clothing of John Connally, I did a lot of research into the clothing of Governor Connally. I feel that someday he's going to be president of the United States if we don't stop this madness. But Governor Connally was shot, supposedly by the same bullet that went through John Kennedy. And they were at Parkland Hospital together. And March the 10th, 1964, Look magazine did an article on John Connally. It was called The Ordeal of Lyndon Johnson, but it went into the clothing of Governor Connally. And it said Lyndon Johnson was sitting with four congressmen, friends of his, in a retreat, which was the minor surgery room at Parkland Hospital. Albert Thomas, Jack Brooks, Representative Gonzalez, and Homer Thornberry, four congressmen from Texas. Federal Judge Thornberry was a Johnson intimate. Clifton Carter was Johnson's aide, who was in the motorcade. And he was serving Johnson coffee, and they were sitting in this room, the four men from Texas with Lyndon Johnson, in the Parkland Hospital minor surgery room. And a nurse entered the room, and she had two small paper bags, and she said they were Governor Connally's clothes, and somebody had to sign for them. So Clifton Carter signed a slip with his name for Governor Connally's clothes. And Mrs. Connally was sitting outside and could have received her husband's garments, or the FBI or the Secret Service or the Dallas Police could have received those garments, because, again, in terms of criminology, the entry or the exit holes in the clothing, how many, would tell you something about where he was shot from. But these clothing were handed in a paper bag to Johnson's aide. Now, Mr. Nogle's article in Look magazine goes on to say that they ended up in the closet of Congressman Gonzalez in Washington. The two paper bags containing Governor Connally's clothes ended up in a paper bag in the closet of the congressman in Washington, the Texas congressman. This is March 10th, 1964, Look magazine. Now, As I said before, all the law enforcement people were there at Parkland Hospital. It was covered with law enforcement people, and these clothing were given to a gentleman who flew to Washington and took them with him. Now, when the Warren Commission wanted to reconstruct the crime, they called in Mr. Frazier, a firearms expert for the FBI. He had 23 years with the FBI firearms training, 23 years a specialist in firearms identification. And Mr. Frazier was called as a witness before the Warren Commission. This is in Volume 5, page 63. And he asked if he had a chance to examine the clothing worn by Governor Connally on November the 22nd. Mr. Frazier answered that he had seen the clothing, but they had been dry cleaned and pressed before he ever saw them, so he had no way of saying as a firearm expert that they were cleaned. And they asked him to describe the clothing, and he said there was a hole in the back of the coat that had the general appearance and could have been a bullet, possibly because of the cleaning of the pressing of the garment. He couldn't say the direction of the path of the bullet. Now, he knows it could have been a bullet because John Connally wasn't going to lunch with four holes in his clothing. You know, he was very cautious. He says it could have been a bullet. Now, Mr. Spector, the author of the Bullet 399, that single bullet that we talked about last week that was supposed to do all of the traveling from the book depository through John Kennedy's back, up his Adam's apple, into John Connally's back, out his chest, into his wrist, and out the other side, into his leg. It was, that bullet 399 ended whole on the stretcher. That was called Arlene Spector's bullet. And Arlene Spector asked Mr. Frazier, was the hole in the back of the jacket, this is in quotes, consistent with a bullet hole caused by a missile traveling from the back to the front of the wearer of the garment? And Mr. Frazier says, I could not determine that. This is the FBI expert saying to him, I cannot determine that. Then the commission went on to the hole in the front of the coat that came out his chest. And once more, Mr. Frazier of the FBI, 23 years of the FBI, said, possibly because of the clinging and pressing of the garment, I couldn't determine whether it was actually a bullet hole or whether it exited or entered that particular hole. And Mr. Spector was persistent, and he said, could this hole have been caused by an exiting bullet? He didn't say, could it be caused by an entering or an exiting. The Arlene Spector says, could it have been caused by an exiting bullet? See, the Warren Report writes up that the clothing of John Connally was caused, it could have been caused by an exiting bullet, the one in the front of his coat. And the answer had to be yes, because he didn't say, could it be entry or exit, you see. So they brought out Commission Exhibit 685, and that was Governor Connally's shirt that he wore under his coat. And once more, they asked him, could he tell whether it was entry or exit by the holes in the shirt? And he said the shirt was dry cleaned and pressed, and the FBI never had time to examine it.
Now, all these things have been dry cleaned and pressed. Who had them dry cleaned and pressed?
Well, who removed the car to Michigan and destroyed it? You know, people, I refer to they, or people want to know they. I think it's up to citizens like yourself and myself to keep wanting to know who. They have names. You see, when I get back to this book, Galen, The Spy of the Century, how do you become the spy of the century? You do all of these things like bring down Gary Powers in the U2 or ruin the summit conference of Eisenhower or plant evidence against somebody to make him get the death penalty. They have names. That's what the way the espionage system works. You have to find out who's doing it, you see. I don't know who sent the clothing to the dry cleaners, but it was dry cleaning to press. This is a fact.
Before an expert
examiner
could look at it and reach some conclusions.
Before any expert could examine it. Now, they have names because shirts don't walk to dry cleaners. I mean, we know it has a name.
That's a safe assumption to make.
Okay. So before he had a chance to examine it, he said, I was unable to formulate an opinion as to the cause of the hole. So he couldn't even say that because he couldn't even examine the hole to see maybe a fist went through it. He couldn't tell by the time he looked at it what the hole was. So Mr. Spector, representing the Warren Commission, then asked him a question to make it more factual. And this is the question the commission asked Mr. Frazier, who can't tell whether it's entry or exit because it's been dry cleaned before he ever saw it. Warren Commission, Mr. Spector, could it have been caused by a 6.5 millimeter bullet coming from the rear of the wearer to his front? The man has already said he couldn't say it, but the commission isn't satisfied because they have to have him eke out some answer that looks like he had an opinion. So he didn't ask if it could be caused by a six-point coming from the back or the front. He could have been caused. The shirt is the front going through. So could he did not ask, can you tell the shape of the hole, what kind of bullet went through? He says, could it have been a 6.5? And this is the way the questions were asked. At that point, the commission says, I want to go off the record. And the stenographer stops, and they have a huddle, which happens all the time, an icky question, because they're not getting very far here. And they have to discuss then the bullet hole in the governor's sleeve, because the bullet still has to go through his sleeve and his pants and come out whole. So once more, Mr. Frazier says the hole was in such condition due to the washing of the material, I can't determine what happened, or if it was caused by a bullet, or the direction of the path with reference to the entrance or exit. That is the FBI expert.
That's off the record.
No, they're back on the record now. Yeah, and he says, I cannot determine the direction, if the hole was caused by a bullet, or the direction of the path with reference to entrance or exit, because of the condition that the shirt sleeve is in, it's been dry cleaned. He's very cautious. He's been 23 years with the FBI, and he is not committing himself. And there's still another bullet hole in the trousers of the governor. And Mr. Frazier still said it had the appearance of a bullet hole, but I could not determine the direction of the bullet, if, in fact, it was even caused by the bullet. So the matter of whether or not the governor's clothing was destroyed, as far as evidence, nobody goes into. You know, nobody asked the who or why. But Dr. Shaw, you go into the testimony of the doctors that operated on Governor Conley, and they think it's impossible that the bullet is doing what the Warren Commission is going to tell you it did. This is why the clothing is so important. When the doctors give their testimony, they say, well, for goodness sake, let's have the clothing. But the men who are in charge of the property that would prove that Oswald did it or find out who did the murder and the direction of the murders have destroyed the evidence. So Dr. Shaw, who operated on the governor's chest, on Governor Conley's chest, said that there were metal fragments in both the x-rays and the wrist of the governor that make it difficult to believe that the same missile could have caused the two wounds in Governor Conley. There's different kinds of metal. Now, you see, this is why it's important to get the x-rays of President Kennedy. Dr. Shaw, in Volume 6, page 113, says that there's metal fragments in the x-rays of the wrist of the governor that make it difficult to believe that the same missile caused the wounds in his body.
And that's a pretty significant statement there.
Well, yes. And it says there seems to be more than 3 grains of metal missing in his wrist alone. You see, we're going to have a bullet come out whole. Volume 6, page 113, he has metal from the bullet missing, and it doesn't match other fragments in the governor. With regards to the one bullet inflicting all the wounds of the governor, he said, I feel there would be some difficulty in explaining all of the wounds being inflicted by bullet 399 without causing more in the way of loss of substance to the bullet or deformation of the bullet. Remember, we talked about bullet 399. The important thing to remember is that one person is doing research on just the direction of the bullet. Bob Cutler, that was at her, has spent all this time, many years, just on the impossibility of that bullet doing it. But the doctors also are saying, the medical team that operate on John Conley are saying it's impossible, and the proof of whether it's possible or not is destroyed. This is the important thing, that the evidence in so many of these cases is destroyed. The doctor said, if the same bullet which went through President Kennedy went through Governor Conley's wrist, I can't quite place where his wrist at the time his chest was struck.
Where his wrist was at the time his chest was struck.
So
the doctors have got some entirely different views on the single bullet theory.
Exactly. And then we go back again to Dick Sprague, who was our guest, who has the movies of his wrist and is trying to tell you that it was impossible for the single bullet to do all that they said it was doing. You see, the men that have worked so hard on the photographic evidence or on the ballistic evidence know that something's wrong because they're backed up by the testimony of the medical teams, you see. And always it's the government that's destroyed the evidence that would prove.
Okay, we'll be back discussing the evidence and the research around the John Kennedy assassination. You're listening to Dialogue Assassination with political research specialist Mae Brussel. I'm Phil Kogan, and this is KLRB Carmel, Stereo 101.7, serving you 24 hours a day.